Welcome to Excel Transformations, a podcast for intense people. My name is Imi, and I'm here with you on a journey. Hi, everyone. Well, today I have the honor to speak with Abel Abelson. Here is his bio. Abel is an intellectually gifted neurodivergent. He was probably left on this planet by an alien race that forgot to pick him up again. And while waiting for their return, Abel turns his stay on Earth to good use. How fun is that? Today we will talk about the nuanced experience of being neurodivergent, the experience of dating, schooling, working, thriving as a gifted, highly sensitive person in a neurotypical world, and why and how he wrote his book entitled it How to Handle Neurotypicals. Now to Abel.
Hi, Abel. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on and speak with me. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Hi, Imi. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really honored.
Yeah, well, I'm honored too. Our theme today is to talk about a lot of the nuanced experience of being neurodivergent, especially when you're more intense and gifted. I mean, I use the word intense. A lot of people use the word gifted. I think people tend to feel, a lot of people tend to feel strange about identifying as gifted. So. But I think to many people who have come out and acknowledged that, that's what we're really talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So before we start, do you mind telling us a little more about yourself?
Well, I'm a guy. I'm 50 at the moment. Mm. And I've always felt a bit strange, a bit out of the... out of the box or something like that.
Yeah.
And when I was around 40 or a bit 40, 42, 43, something like that, I really had a kind of crisis with this. And then I said to myself, I need to know now if it's me who's crazy or weird or if it's them. That's how it was in my head at the moment.
Did anything trigger that incident?
Excuse me?
Did anything happen to trigger that incident?
No, not really. I think it was just a build-up of years of strange, feeling strange and not really, I don't know how to put it. Yeah, like a different animal in the zoo. A bit like that. I described it in my book as a bonobo amongst chimps, which is not... I don't think a bonobo is better or worse than a chimp or vice versa. It's not about that. But they look very alike, and yet they're very different. And that was a bit the feeling I had.
They look very alike, but they are very different. I think that sums it all up.
So to the eye and to the understanding, you'd say it's the same animal, but yet again in the experience, it's very different. So if you would imagine that you would in the zoo, I hope people won't be offended by my animal metaphors. Eh? It's just a metaphor, right?
Sure.
So, but if you would put a bonobo in a group of chimps, he would be really very unhappy. And likewise, if you put a chimp in a group of bonobos, he would be really unhappy because they function differently, although they are very much the same also, of course, but they would be unhappy. And I think that's the kind of unhappiness I had, especially if the bonobo wouldn't know that he was a bonobo and he would think he was a chimp.
Yes.
And it would be even worse, right? So he'd say,
I love that analogy. Yeah, and I like that you qualify it by saying, well, I'm not saying one is better than the other. It's just
that's very important. Yeah.
Mm. One analogy I use sometimes when I talk to people is it might feel a bit more neutral. is a tree. Uh-huh. I just say like, oh, some are taller and some are shorter. I mean, some people will still hear this and say, oh, you're just saying the taller tree is better. But I mean, the taller tree is difficult, right? You're taller, you're more susceptible to the wind. You might break more easily. You know, there are difficulties in being a tall tree as well. It's not like one is better or the other.
Of course, and it's not as if the taller tree serves the world better than the shorter tree,
exactly.
or vice versa. It's a beautiful analogy with the trees, because it's true that the animal metaphors tend to also trigger some reactions that are not intended, right?
Yeah. Well, I think when it comes to the sensitive subject of talking about giftedness, just the word itself makes people feel very sensitive around it.
Exactly.
But then my experience is not usually with people who don't identify with gifted, but people who actually are sitting on the border and thinking about it, they usually have the harshest judgment.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah, but I still struggle with it also, with the gifted word, because it seems like a plus, right? While it's actually a difference. I see it as
it is a neurodivergent trait.
Yeah. It's not like more. I don't see it as something more. I see it as different. And gifted, a gift is something that you receive extra. You know, so I do have a bit of a problem with the word also. Mm.
Mm.
But in the end, it's just words, of course.
And especially when you were younger, I suspect a lot of gifted people have the experience of being attacked and being chopped down when they were just being naturally themselves. So they must have internalized the idea that something about their natural self is a bit too much, that somehow they need to hide to be okay.
And it's also a lot of times, in my experience, people think you're being a bit snobbish or arrogant or stuff like that. But, you know, when you're a kid and you investigated a lot of stuff and you know things, and you talk about it, or you ask the difficult questions, and you know, people tend to think that you're you're trying to put hierarchy in question and stuff like that, while that's not at all what you're doing.
Yeah,
and then you get a lot of difficult reactions from people, which are understandable. Like the teacher in class, he needs to have a certain authority in the setting where he is. You know, in I'd call it more in a neurotypical setting.
Yes.
I think it's more necessary, and then you kind of undermine it unconsciously. But it's not intentional. But you undermine it, and then of course it becomes difficult.
I think you've just captured what a lot of people experience and are not able to verbalize. So, I mean, let's dive in with some more specific questions. I mean, how do you think and why are intellectually intense and gifted, or people who are neurodivergent in this way, get misunderstood? I think there are three settings where they're most commonly misunderstood and it hurts. Number one is the most painful, I feel, but also the most common, which is in their own family.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is in school. And the other one, which I personally, you know, it's in a conventional workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I know it's a big subject, but if you can maybe talk a bit about it, or maybe your own experience, or which one you connect with the most, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in general, big basis of the problem is a blank slate paradigm.
Hmm.
You know, the blank slate paradigm. Tabula rasa.
Thank you.
But
for our audience's sake, maybe it's good to say a bit more about it.
So the blank slate paradigm basically states that everyone is born equally. Like a blank piece of paper or a blank slate, and then during your lifetime stuff is written on it, and that's who you become, which is of course partially true. We're not going to solve the nature nurture discussion here right now, but I so nurture in the sense of the experiences you have has a big influence, of course, mm-hmm. on who you are at a certain moment in your life. But there's also a big influence of nature, genetics, whatever is your biological setup. And the distinction between the two is difficult to make, of course. And I'd like to say also that, you know, there's an ongoing nature-nurture debate, which means how much is due to experience and nurture, and how much is due to the like genetics and stuff like that. I always have the impression that if there's an ongoing debate that doesn't seem to be able to get solved, then the two parts are right, but not exclusively right. So there's this connection between these two influences. But in the end, if you see how society is organized, it's actually organized on the blank slate paradigm. For instance, in schools, kids are put together simply on terms of age. When you're six, you sit together in a classroom with other kids who are six, and you receive exactly the same curriculum. Nowadays, they try to differentiate a bit, but I don't think it's nearly enough or not in the right way, because if I think what I would have needed as a kid, it's a completely different approach to learning. It's completely different. It's not like what they do nowadays. They differentiate in the difficulty level. So they'll give some math to the whole class, and then when you're finished early and easily, they'll just give you a few more exercises that are a bit more difficult. That's not what I would have needed. I would have needed. I would have needed to begin with someone who really, really, really profoundly understood mathematics, because I will always go into the depths of understanding, and I'm not against schools. You know, it's I think it's okay, and it's a bit the bonobo and chimp, or large tree and short tree thing. I'm one kind of tree, and there are other kinds of trees, and maybe these other kinds of trees need these kind of schools.
Yes,
I'm not going to criticize that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I do notice that myself as a kid, I would have needed completely something else. I would have needed someone who really understands and who would go into the depths with it. You know, and I mean, like starting with adding and subtracting.
Have you met other people or maybe young people like you?
I meet some of them from time to time, but the problem is that we are all a bit damaged, actually.
Yeah.
And that makes it really... I've met a few very, very nice people who I felt were a lot like me, and we connected in ways. We connected well, but then being a bit damaged, and maybe we can get into this later, this damaged topic, but being all a bit damaged, it's
I like the fact that you don't dance around the word damaged, because I think that's another word, a bit like victim or things like, oh, you know, that the society doesn't like to use. But I love the fact that you just name it. You know, damage is damage. Damage was done.
Damage was done. And it's damage also, I don't see it as a word that puts blame or guilt. Damage is damage. You know, it can be a volcano that erupts and you have damage.
Yes.
It's nobody's fault.
Yes.
Or it can be someone that attacks someone. And even there, it's difficult to put blame and guilt, because you would have to dive into what really happened. And I don't really, in a certain sense, I don't actually care about the guilt or blame. But I do need to see reality as it is. And as you say, damage has been done, and damage needs to be seen and felt and acknowledged as the first step to do something with it.
Yeah. So, schooling.
Yeah. So I would have needed to start with someone else as a teacher, and then the whole interaction would have been very much different. It makes me think about what a famous scientist whose name I forgot talked about understanding. I think it's Feuerbach, or does he exist? I forgot the name. But it's a Nobel Prize physicist.
Mm.
And he said, if, like, to explain gravity, if you say, what's gravity? Gravity is the force that makes things attract each other, or something like that. And then you say, so why are things attracted to each other? And you say, it's because of gravity. You didn't explain anything at all. You just reworded the thing, and you didn't explain. There's no understanding. But that's the kind of schooling I think I received.
Yeah.
You know, just wording and recipes. And if it's if you do have to do some mathematical operation or something, it's a recipe. And the final effect is that I had to do a lot of reverse engineering, I call it. So they gave me the recipe, and I had to try to find myself the understanding I needed, which a lot of times I didn't even have time, because they gave me so much recipes and so much stuff to memorize. And I was a perfectionist also, so I needed to always get 10 on 10 on my tests, which is for other reasons, which goes into the damaged stuff.
Mm.
But it didn't give me really time. So at the end, I performed very well in school, but I feel now that I didn't actually almost understood anything, not in the way that I see it now, what is understanding.
Mm.
So it would have been it should have been very, very different for me, school. And also the social interactions, I think, would have needed to be very different. And there's also this neurodivergent thing that comes in. I think I would call myself like sensitive, something like that. So if we're in school and we're like 20 kids and they're a bit shouting and stuff, you don't need to shout at me to tell me I should be more silent. You can simply, you know, I'll even notice, but you can simply say it and explain it, which would be even better, instead of yelling, everybody shuts up or we're going to have severe sanctions, you know. And that's the kind of thing where I see a bit of damage also, in the sense that I think for a lot of other kids, it's not that damaging. I think.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know. But I know that for me, it was a bit damaging. And so there you have, again, this blank slate, you know. We're all the same. All these kids are blank slates. And then if they do some kind of, if they have some kind of behavior, we can react in the same way to all these kids.
Yeah.
And so every time there was a kind of a too severe reaction for my nervous system, you know, it was unnecessarily harsh. It was a bit of damage, you know, and that's the kind of damage that then builds up.
Absolutely. And I personally find that insistence on sameness very much exists in the way we structure our society in many, many ways. You know, everyone needs to, there's a subtle script where at certain age we need to be doing certain things. The time of it, you know, everyone needs to get up at 7 a.m., go to school at 9 a.m. Yeah. And it's the same with our workplace, where we have to do nine. I mean, it's a bit changing now with COVID and everything, but still, by and large, everyone sits under fluorescent light, which I really struggle with personally. Do 9 to 5. Oh, I don't understand how people can function in an open workplace. Because you mentioned sensitivities. I wonder if these are some of the things you struggle with as well, environmentally.
More or less, but To a lesser extent. Yeah, I think I have a kind of ability to shut down a part of that. But I do think you are completely right that it's actually completely crazy that everyone should go at the same hour do more or less the same thing.
Because we have different phenotypes, don't we? Some people are just natural night owls. And I think they're changing now that in some countries where they find if they move the school hours 1 hour later, the whole average results gets elevated.
Yeah. So you mentioned age also, which is also a very good point. And even the different stages where you're at a certain age. Like, I think that I, in terms of hormonal development and as a teenager, I think I was a bit later than the rest. So my peers in as a teenager, they were already very much into sexual and that kind of stuff, and I wasn't. And yes. I think it's simply a difference in hormonal structures.
Yes.
And it's the same, you know, like when I was 15, I was in a boys' school, which I don't think was a very good idea, but I was in a boys' school only. And like when I was 15, 16, I found them really all becoming very like rude. And, you know, like testosterone was getting heavily into the thing. Yes. While I was still more like a bit of a kid. And that's also makes it very difficult. Yes. And in the workplace also, we have a lot of differences. What I wanted to say with the age also is that teenagers apparently naturally are more towards night owls. It's just a phase they go through. Everyone, when you're a teenager, you shift to normally you would go to sleep later and get up later, which is what everyone sees. You know, these teenagers, they haul themselves from their bed and they drag themselves to the kitchen in the morning, and at night they still have a lot of energy, and it's a phase they go through. But then again, there are the individual differences, and as an adult, it's true you have to go to work like Nowadays, we have a bit of flexibility, like
Bit, I would think, just a little bit.
Yeah, can arrive between 7:30 and 9 or something like that. But no, it's also, it's crazy. It's really crazy. You ask yourself what we're doing, right? Mm-hmm. All those adults going in mass at the same hour to the same place, and then. It's not possible that we can all be okay in that. We're too different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that also applies to how we approach romantic relationships and sexual preferences. You know, there's still the script too for women to get married at a certain age and have babies. And then, you know, the society by and large celebrates monogamy and certain structures. Which leads on to another topic that I want to ask you about, which is romance and relationship. Do you think, what kind of struggles do you think neurodivergent people usually have?
Yeah, very interesting question, right? It's such an important topic, of course, also, because it's so important for humans to have a good connection, a good relationship with at least one or a few persons. So
yes, but then I would point out that the shape and form of those relationships are less boxed in than many people think.
I totally agree.
Everyone needs to go on.
Well, I think the one of the big challenges for neurodivergent people is, to start with, you don't know you're neurodivergent. That's I think the start of it. So at least I didn't know. I was a kid and a teenager and an adult, and then I didn't see myself as neurodivergent. I just had a lot of confusion in a lot of things. And what my strategy became unconsciously, and I think it's a strategy of of a lot of neurodivergent people is to blend in. We try to blend in because the difference becomes a lot of times if you openly always are your complete different self, it's people can't handle it and you can't handle it. Also, basically, because there's this blank slate paradigm, right? If we would all know and agree that there are these differences and that it's okay, it's like it's all locked in a bit. But the final effect is that we try to blend in, I think. Mm-hmm. And the problem and with blending in...
Yeah. A lot of people might have already been wounded before they knew they were neurodivergent, and they bring their natural full self into dating, for instance, people they met, let's say, on the dating app, they feel very wounded because of the reactions they get.
Yeah, exactly. That's also this kind of damage you get, right? You are your, like, you can be very emotionally open and just be yourself, and then you get a very, very painful reaction. And then you build up a harness. Or in my case, I did a lot of things. I think I built up a harness and I built up a cloaking device, you know?
Yes, where I cloaking device.
A cloaking device, yeah. I'm quite good at my cloaking device, I think, sadly enough.
Actually. A mask, yeah.
Yeah. I just emulate. I emulate what you could call a neurotypical. Doesn't really exist, right? But I emulate, you know, when and I do it all the time. And I think partly it's not a problem because it helps. But we were into this dating and romance and relationship topic. Mm-hmm. And there it becomes a huge problem because... If to put it a bit shortly, we all go about cloaked in the streets and in meetings and then we don't recognize each other because we're masked, you know. And of course,
that is
you can sense
a good point.
Yeah, and you can sense something behind the mask, but who will have the courage to take off the mask first? You know, we don't have that courage often. And then also, again, we are so damaged that we don't dare to take off the mask because we think we will get hurt, even if rationally you could say, okay, this person is probably not going to hurt me. It still is very difficult to just get over all this, just like that. You don't just get over it like that. And so the final effect is that we don't meet. You know?
Yeah, exactly. It is a bit like, I mean, the analogy I use with people is just very neutral, where if you are gay and then you pretend to be straight, it's going to be way harder for you to meet that gay man of your life.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. How are you going to connect if you emulate someone not gay, someone straight?
Saying
right?
that, though, there are a lot less well-made or already made communities for neurodivergent or gifted people. So it's not like you can just join a gay, you know, go to a gay bar or something. There's no gifted bars.
Yeah, and then you have also the problem or the challenge that the neurodivergent communities are fractally neurodivergent again. You see what I mean? So
fractally. Can you expand on that?
Like a fractal, you know, in mathematics, the fractal where you have this.
Mathematics
this kind
of... is the one thing in the world that I've struggled with the most.
Oh yeah, but I'm not a mathematician or I'm not too deeply into it. I just think about, maybe you're too young for that. But like. You used to have these screensavers with all these crazy images on them.
I am certainly not too young for that. Thank you for the praise.
Okay. But no. Okay. So, there are these things that they call fractals. And fractal is like a graphical representation of something mathematical. And then if you zoom in, you see again something like the same image. Or to put it very simply, you could think of a tree. Mm. A tree does have a kind of fractal aspect to it. The form of a tree can be the form of the shape of the leaf of the tree. And then if you see, if you take the leaf, maybe it has the border of the leaf, again, looks a bit like points of the leaf, you know?
Mm.
So that's the fractal image. And what I wanted to say with that is that I, in my experience, neurodivergent communities still are quite divergent within them. So I joined for a brief time the Mensa community in
Me too.
Here, the local one, and I still didn't feel like okay. Here I'm to get my
me too. It was a disaster for me.
Yeah, for me too. So as you say, you know, and I maybe it's the same even for like gay and heterosexual. You know,
that's
I don't
true.
Know. But not every gay person is the same kind of has the same kind of romantic setup, right?
It is so true, isn't it? Because there are many ways I'm different apart from this trait. And I remember how much I struggle where I went in there and everyone seemed to be into STEM and math. And also I was the only non-white person back then under 30. So it was so odd. It was a terrible experience for me. I was of no one's fault.
Yeah. And so that makes it difficult also. And I have the idea that if we talk about giftedness, exactly intellectual giftedness, which is a bit a thing, you know, a concept. I think there are two types of intellectual giftedness, which is not really taken into account. And, you know, like you have the bell curve, and in the middle you have the 100. It's not the IQ I want to go to. You have the bell curve, like for giftedness, and then on the, you would have two sides where you could go to a kind of mathematical memory giftedness, and then you have another side where you have people who are really thinking in a different way and in a very creative.
Ah, is that the maternal fraternal thing you talked about in some of your?
Well, it's there's very how would I say? I started thinking about this because of a theory by a scientist called Baron Cohen, who has a theory about male brain and female brain. But to start with, it should be masculine and feminine, not male and female. And then again, it's even that is very complicated, but because you get into gender and stuff like that, I think it's an unhappy term, masculine, feminine, male, female. But there, that he did notice that there are two kinds of ways in which brains are like set up, and one way is like in the more extremes. In the more extremes, one way is like very mathematical and structured and things like that, and the other is like the opposite. It's extremely flexible and maybe a bit chaotic. And it goes into all directions, and it links everything to everything, and then it forgets again, and then it remakes it, which is also very neurodivergent. And I think intellectual giftedness tends to so, and these two kinds of the important thing is that these two kinds of divergence can score highly on IQ tests, but they have a completely different approach, you know. The one kind will solve a mathematical problem in one way, and the other kind will come from a completely other side and solve it also. And in the middle, the what we could call the neurotypical wouldn't be able to solve it, you know? because they're into other things. You know, it's not because you can't solve the problem that you're less. I always need to really point that out. You know, when I say neurotypical, there are no neurotypicals to start with, but when I say neurotypical, there's nothing less in there. They are perfect life forms also. Mm. You know, every life form is perfect. But and then you have these two types of intellectual giftedness. And then you have a society which says, okay, everybody that scores more than whatever figure it is on the IQ test is part of our community. But then you have this clash again. Well, clash is maybe too strong a word, but you don't really feel connected. The two sides think, I think they see each other as weird also.
Mm-hmm.
Or feel each other as, you know, you're not my kind of animal, really. So that makes it difficult also to connect.
So how have you solved this problem? What would you propose? Starting a dating app for the neuroatypical?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it all
I think I know your views on dating app. What are your views on dating app?
Well, it's not for me. That's for sure. And I don't think I haven't met any people that I feel are more or less like me, or that are neurodivergent, even in another kind of way that I think would be helped by a dating app. Because if I talk about myself, I really need to connect more in depth with people, and a dating app is such an awkward tool for that. It's really not made for that, you know. And dating as such, as a concept, is like I find it really strange. I would find it really awkward if someone would like to date with me. I don't know what they would want to do with me. You know what I mean? If someone would really like to get to know me and do things with me, and you know, I understand that. But dating, you know, like it's such a weird concept
for me. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up without this concept. So I grew up in an Asian context. And I think back then there really wasn't such a thing. Like, you don't meet a person for the sake of that, apart from like arranged marriage or something. Mm-hmm. I grew up with, you know, grew up reading lots of manga, and it's just I have all these fantasies about meeting people naturally, but then when I was thrown into Western context, I had to learn how to date, and then I had to I remember googling, like,
after
3 dates you're supposed to do this, and then after 5 dates you're supposed to in some cultures already be like having sex, and I just like, how? I do not understand.
Yeah. It's I think again it's something like the large and the tall and the short trees. Maybe for the one kind of tree, it's how they connect, how they do it. I don't get into it. And for your question, how to solve it, I think there's a lot of aspects to it. One is really get over the blank slate paradigm yourself, which is already a huge work, actually.
Yes.
Because to start with, in my case, I ended up having built up a lot of anger and frustration and confusion and fear and hurt and all those kind of things. So that makes that when you start really, really, really questioning this blank slate paradigm and incorporating another kind of view in your personal worldview, the first thing you get is a lot of confusion about all this anger and stuff comes up, you know, because the blank slate paradigm kind of flattens it out. There's nothing to be angry about because we're all the same. There's nothing to be hurt about because we're all the same. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So when you start to really incorporate that it's not like that. In my case, I felt like I had to like revisit every second of my past and reinterpret it and understand it. And a lot of those, you know, we come back to the damage. I received a lot of damage, which was not intentional, most of it, but I did receive it. And yeah. When you receive damage, your natural reaction is fight or flight or one of those, you know, anger, fear, things like that. And when you start reinterpreting your past in the light of a non-blank slate paradigm, you need to do something with all this anger and this fear and this sadness also. And you know, you're there, you're like 40 and you have a life and you have complications and you have a work to do every day. You have to go to work because you have to pay the rent and you know all these things, and you have a family, and then all this comes up. And it's really, really, really a lot. So, but you can't even, it's unimaginable for me that you could start to connect with other people like you if you don't go through all that. So that's the first thing. So, you know, it's not about a dating app or not a dating app. It's really about you in the world and you towards yourself, how you see yourself and others in the world, etc. It's kind of I really see it kind of like a rebirth, you know. Not in the concept of rebirthing, it's a thing that exists, but it does feel like a rebirth, I think. You that's why I you know, my name Abel Abelson, it's a pen name. Yeah, it's a pen name. And I chose it because it's kind of Abel, the son of Abel. You know, I parented or I'm in the process of reparenting myself. Cool. Yeah.
And in this process, I would imagine there's a grief that's involved.
Oh, it's terrible.
Personally, yeah. I feel like I spent my whole life mourning the fact that I'm not normal.
Yeah.
And sometimes I still fall into the trap, especially when I have too much time in my hand and I go look at Facebook. And then I will look at what my childhood pals are doing. And then I get back, stuck back into that whole thing of, oh, that's not the scripts that I'm living. And they all are so happy.
Yeah, but they're not. They're not. Mm-hmm. But they look very happy. But that's another subject. But it's true. It's there's an enormous amount of grief to do, and it's in all directions. It's also in all my confusion. I also caused a lot of damage, actually, maybe even to other people like me, while I was trying to blend in, and I maybe damaged them. Yeah, because. Imagine you're in a group, you know, like you're six people around the table, and there's this kind of discussion which I don't like. It can be a discussion I don't like. They're like being very cynical or misogynistic or whatever, and I won't be myself. You know, I will have laughed with them at their not very kind jokes, and then there may be this person. One of the six people is actually also someone a bit like me who is getting hurt by these jokes, and I participate, you know, by not having, I don't really, it's not a thing of guilt and blame again. I end up not having the courage to do something about it. And I in a certain sense, I grieve about that also, because it's, finally, it's so sad that all these neurodivergent and some of them very sensitive people, and we can't even help each other because we're too damaged. But then again, because we can't help each other, we get even more damaged. It's all so sad, actually. But it's not sad in the sense that there's nothing we can do, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's really a lot of emotional stuff to handle, to get into, to And that's the start of all this, you know. When you to go back to this dating and romance and things like that, I think if I think about a romance between two neurodivergent people, I think in the ideal case, these two people are in. They can be in their grieving process. It's okay. You don't have to have finished it. Maybe you'll never finish it. It's okay. But you need to be somewhere in there and not before. Because before that, you are really just surviving. You know, you're in survival mode. When we talked a bit before this interview, I said I was more into CPTSD for the moment, you know, complex post-traumatic stress disorder. That's one of the concepts in that thing, that you can be in survival mode. And when you're in survival mode, you just simply try to survive and you can't really connect with people, with the world. You survive. And while you're in survival mode, that's all you can do. So the whole dating and romance and finding meaning in your life and being happy and all that, it's definitely one of the necessary things to have happened or to start trying to do. It's enough if you start trying to do it, even. Get into that, get out of survival mode, or not even get out of survival mode, just notice. Just notice that you're in survival mode. It's already enough also. Because you at that moment, you drop into reality. You see things as they are. And starting from that, you can connect. Because otherwise, it's just... I have the image at times that we're like people with a cardboard image before us, you know? And we go around and we show this cardboard image to everyone. And then these cardboard images interact. And, you know, that's been a bit my life when I think before my 40s.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And you have to, and the neurodivergent people have to succeed in meeting each other behind the cardboard, you know. And I think it's we shouldn't beat ourselves about the fact that we have a cardboard image. It's okay. No. It's good. It's okay. It's if you need it, do it. And you can be fake. It's okay if that's necessary.
I love that you say there's no need to blame yourself. And I love that you say it's okay to put your mask on as long as it's conscious.
Yeah. It's okay. It doesn't. There's also this thing that putting your mask on, it doesn't really, it's not aggressive. You know what I mean? You protect yourself, and that's okay. But it's just sad if two people with a mask can't really connect behind the mask. That's a bit sad, and we should try to solve that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. So reaching this stage of your life, if you were to change one thing about the neurodivergence community, what would you say or do?
Oh, wow. Oh. As I said, I think it's really difficult in neurodivergent community. Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. I think it's a very good project. But in another way, it's neurodivergent community is it's like it refers to something that it isn't to define itself. You know what I mean? It refers to like neurodivergent is saying we are not neurotypical, to put it briefly. And then you define your own identity around a negative and not being neurotypical. While and it's the same for the dating and the romance and stuff like that. In a very practical sense, what I do in my life, I just go and get into things that interest me and that involve other people. Mm-hmm. And then we meet around those, you know, and it's very changeable. I'm someone who also, I kind of evolve a lot in my tastes and my what I like and don't like. And I investigate something and then I go on to the next. But I can only talk for me. It's a very flexible and movable and like tourist kind of thing. You know, I exploration. It's not a tourist, it's exploration, actually. I go and explore, and at the best moments, you meet another explorer, you know. It's like you go exploring in the jungle or in the mountains, and then you meet another explorer. And that's a great moment. And there you connect. And maybe you and that other explorer, you can just go explore together. For a while, or for many years, or for the rest of your life, or whatever it may be. And that's how I get into connection.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. That's a great solution, or at least a different direction that people can go in, rather than forcing themselves into the mold. I mean, you could say in some of the public platforms that life can become easy and fun if neurodivergent people can find a way to live alongside or amongst neurotypical people.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I wrote my book, How to Handle Neurotypicals. because you have to understand them in a sense. It's not like understand them, but you have to know a bit how they function. And then there's a lot of logic to it, and it's really okay, but you just simply have to not expect things that they are not. It's as easy as that, but it starts again with the blank slate paradigm. First, you get out of the blank slate paradigm, because if it's blank slate, then it becomes a whole other thing you have to do. You know, blank slate is about education and convincing and argumenting. And you know what I mean? Not to give an example, not everyone is equally empathetic. And in the blank slate paradigm, that would be 100% caused by experiences and education and nurture. So, in the blank slate paradigm, what do you have to do? You have to go and try to fix what you see as a perceived, a perceived problem with education, that not everyone is equally empathetic. If you're not in the blank slate paradigm, some people are just not as empathetic as others, or in other ways, or whatever. There are these differences, and it's okay. And then you just don't expect them to be more empathetic, and they're not less of a human being for it. They're not less of a perfect life form, actually, for it. You know, there are apart from humans, there are so many life forms on Earth and in the universe, and they're all really splendid, and definitely not all of them are empathetic, but that's okay. It's really okay, and you don't have to try to change that. I sometimes compare it with if you go to a killer whale and you would try to turn it into a dolphin, as another metaphor, you don't love the killer whale. You don't love it. That's not love. Mm-hmm. That's not, you don't like it. You hate it, actually. And it's an act of hatred in a certain sense to try to turn it into a dolphin, you know? So let the killer whale be a killer whale. It's a very extreme example, you know, because the image of a killer whale is really extreme. Mm. But you know, you have ants and you have birds and you have all kinds of animals that have all kinds of ways to be, and you have humans that have all kinds of ways to be. Mm. You know, and that changes the whole game. And that's I think, how you can be happy among neurotypicals. You leave them be, actually. That's one of the first things. Rule number one, get off their back. Because they're okay.
I think it's hard, especially if you've married a neurotypical person or if your parents are very different.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's really hard. The neurotypical parents, if you're neurodivergent, oh, wow. I think it's sad to say, but there's...
It's so common, though.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was my case also, to a large extent. And it's really tragic in a certain sense, because they can't understand you, and they would like to understand you, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they simply can't. And they try to do their best in so many bad ways, which is so tragic. Yeah.
I hear
and
you.
I don't know what I could... what I could propose to kids of neurotypical parents, you know, apart from the same that I just said, don't expect from them what they can't do.
Yeah, and that goes back to the grief that we were talking about.
Yeah, but it's not much of a solution, actually. I'm sorry to say, but
it's a path. I think just having you name it as a path and have people hearing that, knowing that they're not the only one.
There's also that the feeling felt, that's so important, that you can feel felt, and if it's not by your parents, then by someone else. Maybe that's something I would say to kids of neurotypical parents: go out and try to find people that you can connect with. And I knew a neurodivergent friend of mine. And he said his grandfather, he had a really good connection with his grandfather, which is possible. Or it can be a neighbor, or it can be anyone. Or sometimes it's
a pet.
A pet also. Yeah, right? Mm. Yeah, why not?
Mm.
But don't... The thing is that we are sometimes so entangled with our parents. You know, it's also a term that comes back in CPTSD a lot of times. Entangled.
Well, I think especially a lot of... I just use the word gifted. People are also highly empathic and loyal, and they have high values, and that makes it really hard sometimes to wiggle out of basically codependency with their parents.
Yeah. It's also very difficult the problem, which I maybe it's interesting to know how it's for me personally. I don't have any contact anymore with my parents. Maybe I don't say it's good. Eh? I don't know. It's what happened. And maybe it's okay for people. It can help for people to know that, you know, it's not like it's all rosy and some things don't get solved, actually. But it's okay also. I don't hate them. I don't think they hate me. It's just we can't seem to get along. And it's a big world, you know. It's okay. There's room for me. There's room for them. They can meet lots of people. I can meet lots of people. And sometimes I'm sad because I'd like to have a father or a mother I could, you know, go to and connect with. But it's okay also. You know, that's how it is. It's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry that is the case. And I can hear the sense of come to termness in your voice. And I like that kind of calm compassion you have. It's like, I don't hate them. It is just it is. It's not happy, but it doesn't really traumatize me to the degree that it affects my life.
Yeah, right. And it's a kind of understanding them, you know, in the sense of I understand how it is for them, I think, and it's really hard for them also. They would like a good connection with their son, I'm very sure. But things are as they are also, and it has to do with I think they expect from me a bit to get into the cardboard stuff. You know, just put your cardboard stuff in front of you and we'll go on. And I can't allow that, you know, towards myself. I can't really do that. It wouldn't be good towards myself, you know. So that's where we ended up, well, for the moment.
Thank you so much for sharing that with me and for being vulnerable here. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's no problem. I do that because I know it's what helps me also.
Yeah. Well, I'm aware of time and, you know, thank you for addressing so many difficult subjects with me and being so honest and congruent. Is there any final advice? I know you've already given lots, maybe not advice, but some words or some pointers to say a person or maybe a younger person who's sitting on the fence, you know, wondering, oh, I'm not sure. I've always felt different all my life, but I don't think I want to identify with this word. Should I go get an IQ test? What should I do?
Mm-hmm. Well, the IQ test and things, I did it. And
do you find it validating?
Excuse me?
Do you find it validating?
Oh, I think it's really complicated, an IQ test. I had this friend who was very, very smart. And when he was like 12 or something, they did an IQ test. It's a bit different. He didn't look for it himself. But then they sent a letter to his home. And his mother told him that he didn't have any right to make errors anymore because he was intellectually gifted.
That's crazy.
That's worst case.
It's such a huge misunderstanding of gifted. Yeah. Oh, my God. I'm so shocked.
Yeah. It's terrible, you know. And he told me that he was still shocked about it, of course. Mm. It's very... So it can be... I think it depends. The IQ test, I think it depends on how and why you go into this, into the topic. Mm-hmm. I went into it in a kind of I don't care. I don't care if I get 180 or 80. I don't care. It's just I am fed up with being confused and not knowing. Mm. And if it's maybe it will say something. And in my case, it kind of did, you know. But I think if I would have gotten 100, you know, the typical score, I would have gone to the next investigation of what was different.
So and it's all a quest of you finding answers for why you feel different in your life.
Yeah. And I think you have to, it would be really sad if you would go to, if you're different. I think first thing to know is if you feel different, you are different. You know, that's, I think that's the first thing. So if you feel different and you're confused about
it. I love that you say that because so many people would say, oh, I must just be making this up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to say I'm gifted, I'm making it up.
No, I'm 100% convinced of this. If you feel different, you are different. There's no reason for you to feel different if you're not different.
Thank you for saying that.
And then if you go and you take an IQ test, go and take the IQ test. It will, first off, it will only say what it says. So they have tried to devise something to compare IQs. It's really, in the end, controversial and a bit flawed and all kind of things. So you have to know that it's not like a score given by God, you know. It's just a measure of something.
Yeah. And then they have got like different kinds of tests. It all gets very confusing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's really
And do
it's
just messy. Do the one in Mensa or do you get a psychologist? Yeah. It all gets so complicated.
Yeah. It's a messy topic if you dive into it.
Yes.
But you can go and do it. And then if it turns out that it points to a difference, it's a good start. It's okay. And if it turns out that you feel different and then they say, no, your IQ is really normal, then go on and go look further in all kinds of directions and investigate this difference. And also, very importantly, I think that's the other very important thing, be curious about yourself in a very a positive way, in a kind of, you know, like, yeah, compassion is a good word also, but not like it can become, compassionate can also become like a kind of duty, or you know, it's it's just like you don't know yourself. That's the start. You don't know yourself, and then I would say try to be interested in yourself in a very curious and kind way. You know, don't look for flaws. Don't look for getting. Don't look to become someone else. Because that's also, I was during a long time in this kind of move, trying to become better, trying to solve my flaws and then become someone X or Y or whatever. No, just you don't know yourself, and be interested in yourself, and you know, in a curious and kind way. And whatever you find there, and you'll find lots of things in yourself, whatever you find there, it's there for a reason, and it's there to help you, actually. Even hate and anger and cynicism and frustration and everything that's called negative, it's all there in the end to help you.
Yeah.
That's so if you can go into this kind of exploration, it'll really is a very constructive and a very kind of positive experience with a lot of difficult moments also. But in the end, it's something very positive.
Yeah.
Well, it's my experience. Go ahead.
I find your experience, I find your perspective to be really wise and compassionate and balanced. You clearly have done a lot of work on yourself.
Yeah, well, that's because I also did it all wrong to start with. Yeah, and I think a lot of I know that a lot of things that may appear like, oh wow, he's right. I have that with other people also. It mostly is because these people have tried a lot and made all the mistakes, you know. And then after having made all the mistakes or a lot of the mistakes, you kind of know where it's at, but
I hear you.
But I wouldn't call myself wise at all, actually. But I hit a lot of not at all. But I hit a lot of walls and bottoms, and that's
and I
maybe
think
another
that is
thing.
How you become wise.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I leave it up to you to.
Okay,
decide.
You leave it up to me. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you for being so wise and sharing your wisdom and your experience. And let's stay in touch.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for listening to me. I did a lot of talking. I think I should have done a bit more listening. But...
Oh my God, no, you're a guest of the podcast. That's your job.
Okay then.
Okay. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Bye. Let's stay in touch.
Hey, thank you so much for tuning in. For more, please head to eggshelltherapy.com. There you will find more stories, articles, and resources for people just like me and you. Bye now!
Keep putting one foot in front of the other. Moving forwards, never looking back. Just one more foot in front of all those countless others, and we're there.